Just a reminder that for those of you, if this is your first session, this is the last of, this is step 12 of a big book study, and there's sharing in the other rooms if you want, but I'll just be talking about step 12. Okay. I'm Laurie. I'm a compulsive overeater. I intend to spend tomorrow morning on step 12 from a sort of an overview point of view, but I want to talk about step 12 from the big book point of view at this part of the step study. On page 89, remember, step 12 is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Us big book, or we big book thumpers always say the result of these steps in order to emphasize that that is the absolute promise of this program. Wherever you find it, step 12 says, we will have a spiritual awakening if we work these steps. And if we don't have a spiritual awakening, then we haven't worked the steps. That really is that's what OA stands for. If you haven't had a spiritual awakening, you haven't worked the steps. You may think you've worked the steps, but you clearly haven't. Because if you had, you would have had a spiritual awakening. That's the trust that we have in this program. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of working, Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of this course of, what the heck is it? Oh, I'm really tired. Isn't that embarrassing? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. How do we carry the message? First, why do we carry the message? And second, how do we carry the message? Why do we carry the message? The big book says on page 89, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. Listen to these promises. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover. To see them help each other, help others. To watch loneliness vanish. To see a fellowship grow up about you. To have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And it's true. I can only tell you from my own experience and the experience of hundreds and thousands of other people, this gives us a meaning for our life. And one of the most important things, I think, and I see this in myself, but I also see it in so many other people and people who have been in far worse shape than I have, is that in a very direct way, the difficult experiences that we have had in our lives now become part of our ability to carry a strong message to other people who still suffer. I can't say this, but I have friends who can say, yeah, so you were assaulted when you were young. I was raped when I was 6 years old, and I don't eat over it. And that powerful message that they can bring, I can't bring that, but they can bring, allows them to carry the message to people who suffer problems that I've never even conceived of. They can now give meaning to their suffering. If they're religious people, they may even find or believe that that's part of their journey through life. Even if they're not religious, they can at least say, at least I can give meaning to that. At least I can say that this experience has helped me in some way to help someone else. And I'm in the fortunate, unfortunate position, part of the work I do, as I listen to people who have been sexually and physically abused in Indian residential schools in Canada. We had a whole host of schools that were run by predators. I mean, that's the simplest way to put it. And I listen to them. And one thing I can say to them, I mean, one of the things that, and I'm able to award them some money as part of a whole process, but one of the things that has become clear to me is that they get so much more meaning out of being able to share something that they've kept down inside them for years. And they gain a strength from that. It's part of their tradition as well, but they're able to gain some strength from that and help others who have been through the same experience. I can't tell you, one very famous Aboriginal leader in Canada said at sometime in the 1990s that he had been abused as a child. And that opened a floodgate for all kinds of people who had no idea that other people had been abused. They thought only they had been abused. And to be able to open that door, that one man, an incredible man, I'm able to say that, and I think it's so important. It's also important to be able to stand as testimony that you can be reborn as a different person. I don't mean this in any religious sense, although it may mean religious for some of you, reborn. You can become anew. You can become a different person. I read something by Rabbi Kushner, the guy who wrote When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And what he said, I'm not recommending OA literature, any literature other than OA, but I'll tell you what he said. He said that people who have done evil cannot be forgiven by other people. They can only be forgiven by the people to whom they've done evil, and therefore the murderer can never be forgiven. That's according to the Jewish law, he says. But he says the one thing a person who's done evil can hope for is that he is no longer the person who did that. That he is no longer the person who did that. We have the gift through this program of becoming a different person from the person who did the things that have harmed other people. And that's a tremendous gift. So our experience can benefit others. We will see how our experience can benefit others. That's how it is. I can be a whole human being despite having suffered what has happened to me. And if I can do it, you can do it. And I'll help you. And I'll show you how I did it. So the power that you can get if you've suffered long in your life is so much better than what I can do. I mean, I got a good message. I've been trained well, and I've had a good education, and I grew up with all the advantages of being able to speak well and to convey my meaning. And it's a gift. It certainly isn't something I've had. It's been a gift to me from my upbringing, from the education I've had, from the training I've had. And it's wonderful for me to be able to do that. But the gut one-on-one kind of carrying the message can be done so much better and has been done so much better by people who have suffered much more than I have in this program and are able to say toughly, yeah, so what? You know? Yeah, poor you. Poor you. What are you doing about it? You know? And that power lies in you far more than it does in me. I can give a good overview and all that kind of stuff, but that power of the one-on-one lies in every single one of us. I was once like you. I'm not like you now. You know, people, I remember being at the World Service Business Conference when I'm going to do some repetition. Some of what I just said I think is something I should be saying to the general group tomorrow, but pardon me if I repeat myself a bit more tomorrow. The World Service Business Conference, I think it was in St. Louis, when the Board of Trustees talked about how our membership has really declined and we're in really bad shape. This is about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I think. Yeah, boy, 96, so that's about 13 years ago, almost 14 years ago. And the wonderful thing about conference, I don't know, how many of you have been to conference? Do you agree with me that the best part about conference is not the conference but the OA meetings that you go to? I mean, for me, they're the most wonderful thing. And there was an OA meeting that evening, right, late at night, it was 10 o'clock at night, and people were just despondent, and people were saying, oh, God, where's OA going, what's happening? And some person said, you know, I'm a member of AA as well. And he says, I remember a speaker once saying, he said, AA will never die because somewhere there's going to be a drunk living under a bridge and someone's going to go up to him and say, you know, I was once just like you. Because step 12 requires me to carry that message. Now, it may be, and OA deserves to live only as long as it carries a message that the compulsive eater can still hear. Because we're a trustee of this message. It's our duty to carry the message of recovery to those who still suffer as individuals, and we congregate together as Overeaters Anonymous in order to carry the message to as many as we can. So this life that we now have to live is a fulfilling life, but it involves a lot of hard work. And the Big Book has some very specific suggestions for finding people who still suffer and for carrying the message to them. Now, remember, this book was written for people who didn't have AA in their vicinity. So they spent a couple of pages on how to find the pigeon or the whatever you want to call it. You know, you know, how to find the person and talk to them. And of course, you know, I suppose we're lucky in that respect. People come to us. But it does give us some guidance on how we should be approaching them. And listen to this. On page 90, they talk about a person. You find, you go to rabbis, you go to ministers, you go to doctors, whatever, and you find a person. Wait until he goes on a binge, and then say, let his family, this is on page 9, let his family or friend ask him if he wants to quit for good, and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, listen, this is how you should be described. Then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. Has recovered. Not is recovering, but has recovered. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others, and will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. Now, remember, I think I said this yesterday. When I talk to people about OA and they say, oh, I have a friend who might need you, I say, tell them two things. Tell them that I can have ice cream in my house go bad and I don't worry about it. It doesn't bother me. I can look at people eat foods that I can't have and I'm happy for them. And also tell them that he'd be doing me a favor if he wanted to speak with me. Because that's what the big book says. And people, if they're doing me a favor, then they're much more inclined to speak to me. That if I'm doing them, I'm doing them no favor whatsoever. They may walk out the door. They may not care. They may say, this isn't for me. That doesn't matter. I've done them a favor. They've done me a favor by letting me talk. The essence of this program is I try to carry the message. I may not carry it well, but I try. I'm very mindful of what Dr. Bob said in his last major speech, where he said, we are trustees of our time, guardians of our time. And we aren't making much, we're wasting our time if we don't know how to carry the message well. Because we're spending, he says, I've spent 5 or 6 hours saying to a person what I could have said in an hour. So I work very hard, and I think we all have to work very hard on how to carry our own message, how to tell our stories, how to be able to convey the message very quickly. If you have 3 minutes to talk to an OAer, I think it's a wonderful, I would love to see it, a World Service Business Conference, 1 hour spent taking 10 very experienced OAers and one newcomer, putting 9 of them away while the other one talked and say, you have 5 minutes to talk to this newcomer who doesn't know a thing about OA, what do you say? I think it would be an extremely valuable thing that we could all learn from. I think it's a worthwhile exercise. I know what I would say. I can say it in almost a minute. I have an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind. I would explain what that means, cravings, uncontrollable cravings, and the mind. I would, and I would say the steps give me sanity on the mind. And, you know, I would do what I've already talked to you about. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to talk for 5 minutes and do it. But I've worked it through. I can tell my stories in a very particular way that will show the allergy of the body on the one hand and the obsession of the mind on the other. Because it's that identification that's going to get the newcomer. The newcomer wants to know that I am like him or her, or was like him or her, and that I'm not like that anymore. That's what the newcomer wants to hear. There's nothing else the newcomer wants to hear, unless the newcomer says, okay, now I'm interested, what do I do? Then you bomb them with a, and you say, yeah, it's simple but not easy. You know, can I explain the program in a simple way? I think I can. I think I can give an overview. Now, that's my program. That's my message. You tell your own message, but you all have your own stories. Can you tell your stories of eating in such a way that you can illustrate the uncontrollable cravings and that you can illustrate the obsession of the mind? It's worth thinking about. Anyway, on page 91, they talk about how to talk to the person at the first meeting. And, you know, it's completely different from what the original AAers did. If you read the AA literature, the historical literature, you'll see that they spent hours and hours and hours talking to people. But when Bill wrote this chapter, and this is the only piece of literature that is a do-it-yourself textbook that's ever been endorsed by a 12-step group. Our 12-step group has endorsed it, and so has AA, of course. This had the agreement of everyone there. They all agreed to it, 100 people. The complete membership of AA agreed to it. It was a small membership, but they agreed to it. Bill had been a salesman. Bill knew how to sell. And many of the AAers in those days were salespeople. And they used to, I don't know if any of you have ever been in sales. You ever gotten the script for sales? If he says this, you say that. If he says this, they put the conversation. Insurance people get this a lot, you know, 50-page scripts. And this reads like that. If he says this, you say that. But it's a real script. But it's 2 or 3 hours long at the most. It's just a short talk. It's just whet their appetite. See if they're interested and then leave them alone. And that whole approach of the big book takes is so different from the glomming on that we read about in some AA literature. They just glom themselves onto people, or that we do. You know, what happens... I remember my first couple meetings. What's this program? Oh, well, it's spiritual, emotional, physical, and, you know, sometimes the physical takes care of itself, and I really feel so much better, and I've dealt with, you know, life in general. And I mean, that is, I've heard that. I don't know how many of you have heard that, but I've certainly heard that. And that's what I hear. You know, I've really solved a lot of problems here, and I feel really good. Why did I come here? If I'm going to a therapy group or I'm coming because I have a problem with food. Tell me about food. That's what I want to hear about. The book is very, very clear about that. So you visit the man. Engage in general. I'm going to summarize this because it's kind of long. You engage in general conversation and gradually bring the topic along to drinking. To your and your history only. You talk about your drinking. You tell your stories. You tell them in such a way that they show the twin problems of once you stop, you can't start, and you can't stop from starting. And I have a whole bunch of stories I could tell about my uncontrollable eating. You know, how many here, by the way, have ever taken a carton of ice cream and eaten from the other end in order to pretend that nothing had been eaten? Yeah, okay. I can tell that story. I can talk. But for me, the most powerful story that I tell, it's not a story. I mean, I tell my goose story, which is a disgusting story about eating the entire skin of a goose. But that's a disgusting story. But the story that I think is most graphic is not the story. It's a description of all my eating. And it is the hand going to the mouth, holding a fork maybe, or not holding a fork or a spoon, and my mind saying, I've got to stop, I've got to stop. And my saying, what I have discovered is that hand is yielding to the control of my body beyond the control of my mind. It's like blinking. It's like the heartbeat. I simply can't stop it. And my mind saying, I've got to stop it, I've got to stop it, is the same as if I were saying, I've got to stop breathing. I've got to stop pumping my heart. I can't do that. And, you know, they might poo-poo it, but that's my story. I don't care about their story. That's my story. In terms of the obsession of the mind, I have all kinds of stories I can talk about, but I can just recite a list like this. I'm happy. I'm sad. I'm lonely. I did this yesterday. Too many people around. I'm lonely, or there are too many people around. They made it especially for me. I'll never have this again. It's organic. Really, it's organic butter. I mean, really, it's organic ice cream. Oh, it's got to be good, you know. It's cane juice and not sugar. It's grape juice and not sugar. How many others? I'm standing up. It doesn't count. I mean, you can come up with your own list. You know, they're looking at me. I better do it. How can one little bit hurt? You know, all those examples. And if I don't get someone nodding, then that person isn't for our program. I mean, they all just say, yeah, I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt, you know, that stuff. So that's what the big book says. You tell the story in such a way, and he says, when you see you know all about the drinking game, right about page 91, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. So I begin to say, I learned that I was a compulsive eater, that I could not stop once I started and I couldn't stop from starting, that I was in this yo-yo thing. Give them an account of the struggles you made to stop. Show them the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. Then if you're satisfied that he's a real alcoholic, if you're satisfied, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. And I've got to tell you, there have been times when I have not been satisfied. I've said, you know what? I don't know if this program is for you. You know? I have some friends who are tremendously overweight, but I've said to them, I don't think this program is for you. I'm hoping that they might say, what do you mean it's not for me? You know, but I'm not sure they will. I don't think it is for them, frankly. I think they're too full of pride and too full of boneheaded thinking that they'll never do it. But I said to them, I don't think this is for you, but you've got to do something about your weight. You're going to die. And I don't want to be around helping you out, trying to help you out when you're too sick. If you're satisfied he's a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal function of the willpower. Don't brand him as a compulsive eater. Let him draw his own conclusion. If he's sick to the idea that he can still control his drinking, tell him that possibly he can, if he's not too alcoholic. But insist that if he's severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Bill was very careful, by the way, to call alcoholism an illness and not a disease, because he believed that disease had a medical aspect to it, whereas illness was something that did not have medical. He didn't want alcoholism to be branded with a medical issue. So he used the word illness. I don't think the words have that much difference in meaning these days, but he was very careful. I know that. So I use the word illness. You could use dis-ease. But one of the problems I think we have in our program is that the doctors have got hold of parts of it, in the sense that the eating disorders has become a word in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM, and it describes things together by their symptoms and not by their causes. I mean, anorexia and bulimia are put classed together as eating disorders, when in fact one is overeating and one is undereating. They're both classified by lack of nutrition and by thinness and by real danger to the body. But the difference between a bulimic who only overeats and hides it, and an anorexic who has never overeaten, and I venture to think that very few anorexics in our program have never overeaten, but there are some who have overeaten. There are some who have never overeaten. They can understand us by analogy, and there isn't at the moment Anorexics Anonymous, so that they don't have their own 12-step program, and I hope we can help them. But our story is a story of overeating. And unfortunately, bulimics and anorexics have been taken over in a medical term, and they're clumped together, whereas, I mean, for me, and I'll be blunt, a bulimic is someone who hides what I used to show. That's all. They eat as much as I do. They eat like pigs, just as I did. Anyway, that's a whole topic on itself, and I won't go into it much more. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. And you will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, of the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him he's alcoholic, so much the better. So, they say, even though your protege may not have entirely admitted his condition, he has become very curious to know how you got well. Let him ask that question if he will. So you're keeping the solution away. This is the sales job, right? You're saying, this is what I used to be like, this is what I'm like now. Okay, yes, I understand. This is what used to be like. How did you do it? Then you lay it on him, and they say, tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic. He does not have to agree with your conception of God. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself, and they live by spiritual principles. They say use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. Don't arouse any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are. Please, and I beg you, for the sake of agnostics and atheists like me, please don't try and impose your own conception of God on us or use language that is so specific that it scares people like me away. Now, sure, if we're desperate enough, we'll find something else, but really, don't you owe it to us to find our own conception of God? And then they say, how do you deal with a religious person who has this addiction? And this is very powerful, because they don't let anyone off the hook there. You know, how do you deal with a religious person who may know more about religion than you do? You confess, yeah, you know more about religion than I do, but you sure aren't putting it to any good. You may be a very good example of faith without works is dead. You know? And I think that's really important, that you can be very blunt with them. You may believe in God, But are you allowing God into your heart? Are you really connected to the God? Or have you blocked God off from you? Remember that image, and we agnostics, is that deep down within us is the very fundamental conception of God, but it is obscured by calamity, by pomp, and the worship of other things. This whole concept that it's deep down within us and we've blocked it off explains exactly to the religious person why, even though he or she may believe in God, God's doing nothing for them. They're cutting God off. Open up the valve, God will come into their mind, and they will have a direct contact. This is not against any religion. As a matter of fact, it increases your religious intensity because you will have the direct contact with the God you believe in. But it's pretty tough language. Sure, you may believe in God, but what good is God doing to you? You've blocked yourself off. Outline the program of action on page 94. Explain how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, why you're now endeavoring to be helpful to him. And here are those words that are so important. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. And in AA Comes of Age, Bill says, for the first time when he talked to Dr. Bob, he tried to carry the message for 6 months to people by preaching them to them from above, about his mountaintop experience and the cold wind blowing through and all that. And they all just said he's nuts. But when he finally realized that he was going to drink if he didn't carry the message to someone else, and he had to find someone in Akron, Ohio, where he knew no one, and he finally found Dr. Bob, he said this was the mutual thing. I needed him as much as he needed me. And this mutual thing was the discovery that I made that day in Akron and that created AA. I need you maybe even more than you need me. And because of that, you know, I'm eternally grateful for being able to do this kind of stuff. Without you, I wouldn't be here. And it's so good of you to ask me to come. Make it plain he's under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. And when people thank me, I say, no, you can't. The only way you can thank me is recover and help others. It's the only way you can thank me. It means nothing to me to be thanked, because I'm just a messenger. It's not me. It's the message. Make it clear he's not under pressure. He needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. Shouldn't be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped you more than you've helped him. Excuse me. Well, and they say, you know, he may not like what you do. He may not like the drastic hustling. You say, well, I was like that too, but believe me, it worked. And then you leave. Do not wear out your welcome. That's a short visit. It's just bang, 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 gone. You do not glom onto him. You do not, you know, phone him every day. You let him call you. That's, I think, what the big book says. Sometimes they want to proceed at once. Don't rush them. This can be a mistake. They may become dependent upon you. If he's not interested, drop him. And I didn't realize this, but I heard Sister Ignatia. Sister Ignatia was the person who worked at the hospital. Which hospital was it? In Akron, Ohio. The hospital where Dr. Bob worked. She was the person in charge of the wards, and she gave a talk, and I heard her, I didn't see her, but I heard the tape of it, where she said that there were times when Dr. Bob would say to her, I mean, he'd plead with her to find more room for the drunks that he would bring in to have them dry out, but there were times when he would say to her, kick this guy out, he's not interested. That's pretty tough language, but that's what they say. Let him alone. If they really want it, they'll come for it. You're not in charge of their recovery. And often we're so nice that we kill people with our kindness. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. Yeah, bring your body to the thing and the mind will follow. Well, it might. But if the body feels very comfortable where it is, and it just really enjoys the meetings because it's lonely and the coffee's good, then is this an OA meeting or is this a coffee clutch? You know? And I think the big book stands for that pretty tough position. I'll just go on. If he thinks he can do the job in some other way, encourage him to try some other way. You know, I just need you for the support. No, you don't. We don't give support here. We give a message of the recovery through the 12 steps of recovery. 12 steps to recovery. That's our message. We don't support. We do support, but only if you're working the steps. Then we support you in working the steps. We're not a support group. There are support groups for people who overeat. They don't charge very much, and they're very popular. Go to them. A little provocative there, eh? Do not be discouraged on page 96 if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with the first half dozen prospects. He often says if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. Now, I take that pretty seriously, and I do not spend a lot of time with people. When I sponsor, boy, I just let them do their work. I don't do a lot of work for them. They have to keep track of where we are. I can't remember where we are in reading the book. They have to keep track of their own recovery. They have to phone me and make arrangements to see me if they want to see me. I'm not their nursemaid. I'm just not taking care of them. They have to learn to be on themselves. And the big book talks about that. By the way, suppose now you're making your second visit to a man. He's read this volume and says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you're available if he wishes to make a decision, step 3, and tell a story, step 5. But don't insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. He may be broken homeless. If he is, you might try to help him by getting a job or give him a little financial assistance. I'm sure many of you have heard Clancy, the great AA speaker, talk about his being kicked out of the last flophouse in Los Angeles, and he goes to an AA clubhouse to get some donuts and coffee because he has no place to stay. And he's toothless, he has his front teeth have been knocked out, and he tells one of the story about that. You know, as I was flying through the air when the bouncer kicked me out, I realized that with all my scientific and psychiatric training, I could really diagnose his problem. He was angry, you know, something like that. He's just hilarious. But anyway, Clancy talks about he's munching his donut without his front teeth and no place to stay, and he's drinking coffee, and the guy comes up and says, "I'm your sponsor, I'm Bob." "Oh, hi, Bob. Read the book." "Well, I'd sure like to read the book, Bob, but I have no place to live." "And read the book." "Well, I have no place to live. I have no job. I read the book." You know, it's that kind of that toughness. It's a wonderful story. And then they talk about what do we do for this alcoholic? Now, a lot of, I don't know how many people come to OA who are in financial need. Many of them may be in real emotional need. Do we help them? And the answer they give is a relatively complex answer. Yes, but only if they don't ask for it, in a sense. If they ask for it, we got to start worrying about it because they may become dependent upon us. And listen to these words. And this is why I say you don't need a sponsor. Not that you shouldn't get one, but you don't need one. And that's why I say that sponsors should be relatively humble about their work because they're only there to give their experience. They say on page 98, "It is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes a difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for." Nonsense. The shortest sentence in the big book. Obviously is the other short sentence, but it has a slightly more letters. "Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. And once he gets well, he also has to help others." Trust in God, clean house, and help others. So the big book's approach is really tough. And it's just sort of, you got to do it. I'm not going to hold your hand while doing it. It's up to you to recover, not up to me. And if you start depending on me to help you through the steps, then you're going to be dependent upon me instead of upon God. Your dependence must come from a higher power. That's where you're going to find the answer, not from me. I'm not your higher power. I'm someone who's been there, done that, and willing to help you. Then they talk about, on page 100, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hand were better than anything that we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances is. You can be broke and homeless, and you will be in a new and wonderful world because you are following the dictates of a higher power. And that's been true, you know, if you do that. So they talk about that, and they say at the bottom of page 100, assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must go to meetings where they don't discuss food. Are there any meetings around that you're aware of where that you can't talk about food, specific food? Well, think about that. Think about going to an AA meeting and someone saying, and then I took into my hands a glass filled with a brown amber fizzy liquid, which I chased down with another brown liquid. I don't know if any of you know Bob F., who's a trustee from Toronto, but he talks about being at a meeting once where you weren't allowed to mention food, and a person talked about eating something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he described something like a round, dark ball. And three people met after the meeting and said, what the heck was she talking about? And each one of them had a different idea, and they went to her, and it was a fourth thing. They were more obsessed about food than not. You know, how can I tell my goose story about how I ate a whole goose skin after having had a huge meal without talking about goose and skin and eating? How can I talk about I can have ice cream go bad in the freezer without talking about ice cream? My stories about food are the stories which people can identify with. I don't think you will identify with the goose skin story, but you can identify with many of my stories. How can I tell that without talking about food? And so what if some people say, oh, I'm going to eat now. I thought about food, I'm going to go eat. Well, maybe they'll become more desperate and work the steps. Or maybe they'll leave the meeting until they're ready to be desperate. But whatever it is, you know, it says, people have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friend must hide their bottles if we go to their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There's something the matter with his spiritual status. Next paragraph. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We've tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. So, pardon me?
What about the next paragraph?
Our rule is not to avoid a place where there's drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, and even plain ordinary whoopee parties. I'm sure we've all been to these ordinary whoopee parties. Now, these are a whole bunch of cushions on the seats, and we all sit on them and go, kee! Right? But a whoopee party in 1939 was a place where you'd drink and play whoopee. To a person who has had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. You will note that we made an important qualification. Ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? In other words, is there someone else whom I can help for going to this place? Have I got a good reason in business to advance my own business, which will help others, not just me? Have I got a good social reason? Am I paying some respect to a friend or to an acquaintance? Have I got a personal reason? Is it something that I feel I have to do for my own conscience for going to this? Do I have a purpose? If my purpose is outside of myself, I go. But if I'm not sure, it says, am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? If you answer these questions satisfactorily, you need to have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whichever seems best. But be sure you're on solid ground before you start, and your motive in going is thoroughly good. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring it to it. But if you're shaky, you better work with another alcoholic instead. So You know, I say to people I sponsor, I say, you know, how do I sponsor? I'll be very brief on this. I have a very hands-off method of sponsoring. I'm not suggesting it's necessarily completely effective. It works. When it works well, but it doesn't always work because some people just don't want to have a sponsor like me. But I say to people, it's up to you to tell me where you are. I will not talk to you on the phone. I will meet with you. I don't want, you know, for me, the phone is, you know, if you talk to me on the phone, if you phone me up, and I'm anywhere near a computer or near the dishes or any, you know, my hands will be kept busy doing something. And sometimes my mind might be a little off playing solitaire or something of that sort. You know, I'm terrible on the phone. I can't stand the phone as a method of communication. For me, face to face, when I'm looking at a person, that person's looking at me is by far the best way of being able to sponsor. So I do that. I mean, I do have some phone sponsorships, some even some email sponsorships. I've never felt that they've been as powerful, and I always encourage people that to find someone in their area because face to face is so much better. Anyway, I meet with them, and I take them through the steps. I take them through the big book method of doing the steps. I explain the things. I take them through step three and then give them the forms and tell them step four. I say it's time now. It's time for you to fill out those forms, and if you want help in filling them out, I'll be happy to do it. But what I do when they start on a plan of eating, I say, let's develop a plan of eating. That's step one. We have to figure out what you can't eat, what you have to abstain from, and how are you going to accomplish that? What's your plan? I say, you're now in a race. Did I tell you this? I think I told some people that. I didn't tell all of you. Did I already? You're in a race? Huh?
Yeah,
okay, well, some people heard, some people didn't. So you're in a race with your mind. Either you're going to recover, finish step nine and recover and won't want to eat this stuff, or your mind will persuade you that it's okay to go back to it. So it's up to you to do the steps quickly. And I will do anything I can to help you not eat the foods that you are abstaining from. I'll help you all I can to abstain. If you, at 4 in the morning, are about to eat a donut, call me up. My wife understands. I'm ready to help you. I'm ready to meet with you. I'm ready not just to talk on the phone with you. I'm ready to meet with you. What would an alcoholic do if an AA member do if someone said, I'm about to have a bottle of beer? Let's go for coffee. Let's go right out. I would do that. Never had to, but I would do that. I say, anything that I can do. If phoning in your food every day will help you, you can phone in your food to me. But you know what? It'd be far better if you spoke to a newcomer and said, can I phone my food into you? Because it'll help me if I phone my food into you. It'll help the newcomer. You know, so why don't you do it? I don't need you to phone me. It doesn't help me to phone me. But if you want me, you can phone me. Phone me anytime if you're about to eat. Don't phone me after you've eaten until you've had a night to sleep on it. Then phone me and we'll figure out what you did wrong. I've never fired a sponsee, although a lot of them fire me, but I've never fired one. I've always said, okay, you've relapsed. Let's figure out what you did wrong and let's not make that mistake again. Let's figure out how to avoid that mistake. I will very often say to people, before you even adopt your plan of eating, make a plan for step five and figure out a timetable for you to work through the steps so that you can finish your step five, which means you finish your six and seven and are on to your eight and nine. And because then you can hold on for a month. If you know you've got a month to your step five and you know you've got a specific plan for doing the step five, most of us could hold on for a month and not eat the stuff. You know, we've been on diets enough that we know a month is good enough, maybe even 2 months. But 6 months, a year, how many of us have ever been able to hold on to a diet for a year? I haven't. And so I say, do it quickly. Get it done. And I'm here whenever you need me. But it's up to you to tell me. And I'm not going to call you. And people who last through that, you know, and then I take them to the, you know, I do, if they want to do step five with me, they do step five with me. If they don't want to do step five with me, and you know, I sponsor a lot of women, and some of them do, and some of them don't want to do it with me, then they go to someone else. But I'll tell them how I think the big book talks about doing step five. I'll tell them how to do six and seven and eight so that when they do step five with someone else, they've worked it through. And then they, you know, let's say they finish step nine and they're feeling great and they're living and they're wonderful and everything's terrific and they're losing weight. I say to them, okay, now it's 10, 11, 12. I explain the importance of 10, the importance of 11, the importance of 12. Go out and sponsor. You're ready to sponsor. Don't even hesitate to put your name down as a sponsor. Don't even hesitate to volunteer as a sponsor. And I'm really careful these days in meetings, because I've been around for such a long time in my hometown that although I say I'm available for sponsor, I don't really push myself. I'd rather much more let the people who are just starting get sponsees. I have enough, and I don't push it, because it's very important for them. And then the question is, do they still call me their sponsor? Well, some of them do, but I don't talk to them very much. I don't have much of a relationship with them unless they want to do a step 10 with me, the step 5 part of a step 10. Then I'm available, or they need some assistance or experience in how to help sponsor someone else. I'm having this problem. I don't know what to do with it. Or can you think of the kind of amend that this person could make? Because I can't think of an amend, and either can she. You know, and maybe we could figure out an amend that wouldn't harm anyone but would still make her feel better. So that's the kind of thing I'm doing. I think they should be spending their time not with me, but with people who still suffer. You know, one of the things that has killed me about some of the meetings I've gone to is that I've gone to meetings where there have been 30 people in the room, lots of recovery, and then they go around, who's available to sponsor? I'm so-and-so, I'm a compulsive overeater, I'm a sponsor, but I'm not available. I'm so-and-so, I've been absent for X number of years, you know, but I'm not available to sponsor. I'm not available to sponsor. I'm not available to sponsor. Why? Because they're too busy talking to the people who have already recovered, because they don't have enough time to talk to people who haven't. So I don't have anything against other methods of doing the steps unless they impede the ability of a group to provide assistance to those who still suffer. Then that group has to really think about themselves. So there are groups in Minneapolis, for instance, that have a very structured view of the program. They have recovery galore. There's never wanting, there's always sponsors available there. So even though they can't sponsor more than two or three people, each person can't sponsor more than two or three people because their method of sponsoring requires a lot of time spent, they always have people ready to sponsor. God bless them. I don't question that at all. But if a meeting has no one available to sponsor because everyone is too busy sponsoring someone else and their method of sponsoring takes so much time that the newcomer suffers, what's the primary purpose of every OA group? To help the compulsive eater who still suffers, not the compulsive eater who doesn't suffer anymore. So I, from my point of view, I don't spend a lot of time with the people I sponsor. They don't spend a lot of time with me. When they need me, I'm there. When I need them, they're there. I tell them, I want you to be sure to tell me if you think that I'm not in good shape. And they have. They say, what's wrong with you today? You know? Sometimes I use them to give my step 5 to. Do I have a sponsor? Well, I have 4 or 5 people I talk to whenever I need to talk to them. Are they my sponsors? I guess they are. I guess I could call them my sponsors, but I mean, what's the advice I give to most of my sponsees? Take a step 10 and call me in the morning. I mean, that Lori, I don't know what to do. I've got this and this problem. Do a step 10 on it and call me in the morning. I mean, that's my advice. So when I'm frazzled, I don't know what to do. What do? I do a step 10. I get my answers. I mean, my program is outer-directed and not inner-directed. I don't live much. I try not to live in myself because I'm not a very good place to live. And I want to help others who are still suffering, not those who have recovered. So that's as much as I'll say about step 12. Thank you for sitting through this lengthy thing. I'll talk more about step 12 tomorrow as a keynote speaker. Thank you.
I just want to say we need to clear out so they can get this room set up for dinner if you want to eat later.